We are recording, so if people can speak out, it helps enormously.
Right. So, yes, we're putting these talks online so that people that can't come for certain weeks can listen to them when we get them up. So it usually takes a couple of days to put them online. And there's a card in the back with the website if you haven't found out about that yet. So Mike will say more at the end. So this is the third class. And the first two were more introductory classes. And this is the first class we're starting to use this book. It's called The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearlessness in Difficult Times. And it's fine if you don't have the book and you haven't read it yet. That's fine. We'll just be talking about it, and I'll be giving a general introduction, so basically covering the material tonight, and we'll talk about it together. So this book was written by Pema Chodron, and Pema is an American Tibetan Buddhist nun, so she studied within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. She has a very interesting life. She's married and has, I think, at least two or three children, divorced and remarried and divorced again. And she was teaching elementary school, so she's a teacher. And at some point she met her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who is the person that all three of us have studied with. And I think she really felt like she was really looking for something deeper and had a calling to actually take monastic vows, which is quite unusual in the West. So she did that. It was quite a difficult journey because the actual path of monasticism was not continuous within Tibet, and so she had to go to Hong Kong and do it through a Chinese tradition. In any case, she was one of the founders of Gampo Abbey in Nova Scotia, and that is, I think, the first, I think probably the first Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Canada, so that's in Canada. And she lives there part of the year and teaches there. And I had the good fortune of knowing her. I also did a similar retreat. She did the three-year retreat at Gampo Abbey, and I was in the group after her group. And I was asked to stay. I did 1 year of retreat, and then I was asked to stay on as head of practice at Gampo Abbey. So I actually had a chance to participate in the program called Yarne, which is during the winter months. Traditionally in India, the monks would go begging in the summer. They could not beg during the summer because when it would be the rainy season, they weren't able to actually go out because they would be stepping on bugs and they were not supposed to kill anything. So they would traditionally have a retreat during that time. So at Gampo Abbey, they established the retreat time as the winter, which would be the natural time to actually do a retreat in a northern climate. So I was actually with her and in this retreat situation. So she was giving a lot of talks, which was really helpful. And when we get to the part more about Tonglen, I'll share some things about that. But in any case, I think her style of writing is very accessible. And what I admire about her so much is that she takes Tibetan teachings or basic Buddhist teachings and distills them, makes them very accessible, because I feel like she really lives those teachings and chews on them and figures out how it works for her and then really applies them. So what you get is less of a traditional kind of layout, although the actual core of the teachings are there, but you get a lot of her experience that comes through, and I think it makes it very, very alive. At least it does for me. So this book is actually an entry into the Mahayana teachings for our group, And Mahayana is means the great vehicle. Maha is great, and Yana is vehicle or path. And that term means that it talks about actually the path involves others and opening our heart of compassion to others. And that's the path that we're talking about when we study Mahayana teachings. So we're beginning with this book because it has some very good practices on compassion, and that seemed to be a key and things that people are interested in within this community. So we'll be actually doing some meditation practices that relate to compassion. And as you read this book, it's quite easy to read, and you can just read all the way through, that's fine. But we'll be assigning certain sections as we go. And there are actually meditation practices and contemplations in the back of the book. So we'll be working with those as we go along. So two of the main practices you will encounter here, one is called the Four Limitless Ones, or the Four Limitless Qualities. So we'll be working with that. And the other one is called Tonglen. We'll be working with mind training and the practice of Tonglen. So that will come up as we go along. So last week, Michael Fagan talked about the Buddha's path to realization. And briefly, the Buddha was a person who was looking for the truth for himself. And he did many different kind of practices. And eventually, he sat down under the Bodhi tree and went through a process of looking deeply into his mind. And through that process, he discovered the deep fundamental truths about reality. So we follow actually that same path of discovery, and we follow that by the path of meditation, what you've been instructed in tonight. And through following and working with our own meditation practice, we actually uncover for ourselves what that truth is. So through our practice, we look at our mind and learn more about our own mind and our own awake nature and our own confusion as well. So Pema talks in this book about the facts of life, which I think is a wonderful way to describe something that's usually called the three marks of existence. So the facts of life actually is really what it is. And this is what we discover when we actually sit on the meditation cushion ourselves. And the first one that is talked about is impermanence. There was a teacher that came many years ago, I think it was the 16th Karmapa, and a journalist said to him, well, could you sum up Buddhism in one sentence? Oh, okay. And he said, he looked at the guy and he said, everything changes. And really that is like the core of the teachings of Buddhism. That if we really look at it, we realize that everything changes. And our basic approach to life is trying to make things, trying to hold on and keep things in order and have some sense of controlling that change. But the fundamental teaching is about letting go into that impermanence and that constant change. So when you start to explore this impermanence and look at how things are always changing, you start to realize that nothing's that solid about yourself either. That all the things that you kind of build up around yourself, you find aren't really that permanent or solid either. So, for instance, one day you might have one emotional state, and another day it's completely different. So there's changing feelings and bodies, all sorts of things happen in our body. And in our life, everything's shifting. So there's no solid self either. And this is called egolessness. So this is the second fact of life, or the second mark of existence. And the third is an understanding of suffering or dissatisfaction. So as we discover this sense of shifting ground or lack of solidity, then we can sometimes start clinging even more and tighter by solidifying our opinions and our views even more. So we actually can start, when we understand the root of this suffering, we can start to see that we could actually let go more and more. And that letting go is a sense of freedom and being able to dance with the energy of the world. So I thought we could actually do an exercise. We'll see how this goes. But sit up, and maybe if you do this more at the edge of your chair. And then just put your hands up this way. And now close your fingers around your thumbs, and really grip, tighten that fist, tighten your fist, and feel that tension all the way up your arm, into your arms, your shoulders, through your body. All the way through your body. You might feel your breath begins to be constricted as well. There's a sense of tightness and holding. And then just begin to let go gradually. Just let your fists slowly open. You just sort of feel almost that residual tension as your fists begin to open. And allow your breath to flow naturally. Take some deep breaths. Just relax. So sometimes it's interesting to have a contrast and feel that sense of holding on and then that sense of letting go. So this holding on is also holding on to our version of reality, our narrow version of ourself, which we feel we have to protect from whatever comes at us. And therefore, there's a sense of almost being in a cocoon or a prison. And I'd like to read this quote. I read this actually to the congregation in January when we did, our group did a service here. This is in the chapter 2, Tapping into the Spring, and it's by Albert Einstein. A human being is a part of the whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening the circle of understanding and compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. So like a sandcastle, we keep building and shoring up all these parts of our lives, and then we find that things are changing and opening, and one door opens, another closes. And the practice is one of actually learning to let go. So what we learn in meditation is on the out-breath we let go. And that's the beginning of this connection with something called absolute or ultimate, or I think Pema calls it unconditional bodhicitta. And this is open space, free from fixation. It is a sense of you could say room, more room in your mind, more room everywhere. The image that Pema uses is tapping into the spring. And she talks about being at Gampo Abbey and they're digging foundation for the retreat center. And as they were digging, the solid rock gave way and a little water came out. And they were tapping, actually, as they were working there, the spring started gushing through this space in the rock. So she talks about that, that spring is like the center of our being, that we have this quality within us that is really limitless, and it's a source of our energy and our joy as well. But we can tend to cover it over so rigidly with our opinions and our fear, basically. The practices we'll be doing will help us work and find this place of fearlessness, because this is a guide to fearlessness in difficult times. So we'll be working more with some practice to open the heart and actually be willing to be in places that are more painful and be more willing to be with other people's suffering. And that's the second part of the bodhicitta, which is the relative bodhicitta. So relative bodhicitta is the ability to actually stay with suffering and stay with the things that are painful in our life. So that word bodhicitta, the first part means awakened. Bodhi means awakened. And the second part, citta, means heart-mind. So within the Eastern traditions, they don't think of mind here and heart here, but heart-mind is one term. So that term, bodhicitta, is are, you could say, the core of our being or our potential or our seed of awakening. And that's what we touch into when we do meditation practice. And with that meditation practice, we actually can start to expand more from that. And this compassion actually arises naturally. It seems quite miraculous to me that you could be sitting on the meditation cushion and your mind can be very busy. And as that starts to still and you touch into this more open space, that from that place, actually, compassion can grow further and further. So that's a personal journey that you'll discover on your own. And you'll see for yourself if that's true for you. So this is a practice, and especially the practices we'll be working with, will actually take us perhaps to places that are more frightening for us in terms of touching into feelings that might be more difficult. But with the meditation practice, we'll be working with all of this and hopefully learn how to widen the circle of compassion. So I think I'll stop there, since I seem to have talked a few minutes longer than I planned. And we can just talk about questions you have in the reading or anything I might have said tonight. This book will cover a number of topics that where we'll just get short bits about things, and then there's a lot more that you can do in terms of deeper reading, and we'll be making suggestions on the website about that, as well as YouTubes and video things you might want to access. So there'll be more to come. But feel free to bring up anything that might have come to you in the reading or through anything that's come along so far. Okay.
It feels like you've been hearing and trying to clear your minds, and yet you're saying there's going to be likely more stuff coming up. So when it comes up, are we letting it stay, letting it go? You know, what are we supposed to, right. What do you do with it?
Right. Well, when you're in meditation practice, you just follow the technique. Mm-hmm. As things come up, you can label them thinking and go back to the breath. That's the basic meditation technique. So that emotions are also considered thinking. So you don't have to figure out if it's a thought or if it's emotion or if you feel it in your body or something. You don't have to analyze it. You can just go to the breath, back to the breath. At other points and at other times in different meditation instruction, there'll be more emphasis on actually touching the feeling or looking at it more deeply.
So it's sort of separate events.
Yes, it can be taught at different times. But the beginner's practice is really to look at whatever comes up, not judging it or not labeling it in terms of it's this or that, but just coming, noticing it, and coming back to the breath. So we're working with this gap, and this gap is actually the space that that helps start to open up the practice more and more, to be present. Because when our mind is going off, if you notice, you really notice you're either in the past or in the future, you're never really in the present. And it's really coming back to the breath that reminds us we're actually in the present. Does anyone have other comments on that?
No, but yes. I also have kind of a beginner's question.
Yeah.
So you're focusing on the breath, but in another talk, someone mentioned simply being aware and present in the moment. So that, you know, if I'm sitting on the meditating, I can have all of my concentration, my focus be on the breath, you know, like one-pointed meditation, versus simply being aware of my body, the room, not having thoughts, but just simply being there. Do you have comments about that? Which is preferable to be doing?
Well, as we go along, we talk about actually 25% attention on the breath, and the rest of the attention is just awareness. Space. So we don't talk about that right away, but it's actually also part of the practice. So you've been meditating for a while, and it would make sense to me that you put your attention on the breath, but you also have a sense of awareness of the space around as well. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does.
So
it makes more sense to me in a way than the one-pointed meditation.
Right.
So are you saying that one point of meditation is a step in the process?
That's one step in the process, yes. It can be taught as one step in the process.
So it's something then that you don't come back to?
No. So at different points you might do that. Let's say your mind is very wild. and you're just all over the map, then you work with that technique of noticing and coming back to the breath. Then you settle down more, and then there's more relaxation within your practice. So you can, you don't have to be so pinpointed on that, and you can have a little more awareness of the space around that. So there's a tension to you kind of holding both at that point. Did you want to say something?
Well, there is also, you know, if you just do the one point, that's very demanding, and it requires a lot of concentration. And in fact, it's meant to develop something called concentration, but it's not meant to be, for instance, if we sit for, say, an hour or 3 hours or 6 hours, it would be very arduous and demanding to simply stay with that. So you'll do that for periods of time in the meditation sessions. And then, as you say, about opening up and being present, that is absolutely part of the whole process. In fact, you could use those as a kind of a means to rest and relax, and you could return to that. But definitely, we never look at this one-pointed thing as an end in itself or something that's the fundamental basis for meditation. It's just a way to sort of stabilize the mind a little bit. And there are other ways to do it.
Right.
I mean, using your out-breath, because what we call close placement is when you're actually only focusing on breathing in, breathing out. And oftentimes it's associated with counting. And if you try that, you'll find out it's actually a mental exercise to do that for any length of time. So our teacher and his tradition, which is really connected with something even larger, we call it Mahamudra tradition, is about the idea of simply introducing the notion that we fundamentally put a slight emphasis on the out-breath and use that to relax. And the in-breath is, you're not worrying about that because you want to give yourself room for things to emerge. You actually want to allow, you're trying to understand who you are and what you're doing. And so you're not simply trying to control every second. You're leaving some space open for things to emerge. That's very important.
Have people been able to work with their meditation practice during the week? Have you been able to have a practice? Are you starting to do that? Yeah. How's that going?
Another meditation question about breath. So generally I tend to follow the breath, and then when I relax I can have a more general awareness, but I always end up thinking and go back to the breath. When I'm following the breath, I find it very difficult not to control the breath when I'm watching it. And I read somewhere that you shouldn't be doing that, but I don't know if that's true.
Like in and out, or like how long?
It going in and out. It's like you are now aware that you're breathing, and you're manually breathing. I'm like, okay.
I think it's you let the breath be, you know,
it's
as best
hard.
You.
Like some at times, I will specifically try to just let it be, and it's like I can't let go of doing it consciously.
That's why the out breath is just, you know, the exhalation is just simply relaxing. And so if you find yourself there, that's where you need to be. That's what you want to work with. You know? But be friendly towards it.
Okay.
And don't get angry at yourself because it's you discover yourself in the middle of all.
That's it's not worthwhile to get angry about that.
No.
can I
yes.
just add something? Just because I struggle with this a lot, you know, and that actually is a part of learning who you are and what you're up to, you know, and so it's something I learned about myself that I'm always trying to control stuff and trying to make stuff go.
right.
So that's part of my practice.
Yeah, so that just noticing is the first thing, as you said, and you start to see what your patterns are. I mean, some people will talk about, you know, they're seeing things in the rug and they're getting all distracted by these visuals, and so that's sort of something that they're bringing up, because in a way that's what they're clinging to, or that's starting to be their issue or whatever. So you just start to see what's coming up, and then you just let it go. And you go, okay, well, that's what I'm doing, but I'm just going to come back every day. I'm going to do my 15 minutes or whatever, and it will change. It will change.
Yeah. Were you having a hard time establishing a daily practice, or do you want to?
Are you asking me specifically?
Yeah.
I don't have a hard time.
Okay. Are you
because I do it in the morning.
Okay.
So, you know,
okay, so
but I do 15 minutes.
What's fun?
You know, so it's easier in the morning for me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It is for me too.
And often doing it in the morning, it sets a tone for the day. And I notice when I practice in the morning, then during the day I might notice more, sort of that pause. So we can actually stop during the day sometimes and just stop and look at the sky or notice what we're doing when we're washing dishes or whatever we're doing, that sense of coming back to the present and being with that activity totally. In fact, it's actually really good if you can think about some daily activity that you do and think about using that, maybe say for a week, and try to be really mindful while you're doing it, like brushing your teeth. I mean, we all brush our teeth, and I mean, I'm sure it's just so hard to even imagine that you're awake and present when you touch the toothbrush and pick it up and go through the stages, because how many people are really present when we're doing that simple task? So sometimes picking something that's very familiar and making that a very conscious practice can be really good in terms of bringing the awareness into your daily life.
I use washing dishes.
Yes.
It's the best. And I do dishwashing by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to spend time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
dish.
True.
But it is so good to have a group to come to,
mm-hmm.
also to have, you know, a longer practice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is a different experience.
Yeah.
In a group.
I think you're
it's
right.
It's like anything. You
yeah.
know, I do yoga. It's very different doing yoga by myself
mm-hmm.
than doing it in a group.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, any of these things. I think yeah. it's so important to have a group to go to.
Yeah. Was there anything from the reading that that came up for people in terms of the any questions or?
I think I need to take notes next time because I did the reading and immediately forgot all of it. And I'm really sorry.
Well, you know, it's interesting
so
you
much.
Say that. I find
I think
it.
I need to do a reread. Is what
well,
I'm saying.
You know, in some ways, I find it a little difficult because. It's in a way very simple, but it is hard to kind of what were all these topics? She actually covers quite a lot in here,
yeah.
And yet they're more from her experiences, and it's hard to say, okay, now what was that that was really covered here? But I think, you know, the main point of the first part is about the excellence of bodhicitta. And this is what she talks about as the soft spot, that we all have that soft spot. And she talks about putting up this shield or walls and that sense of protection. But underneath that is this genuine heart of sadness. And I think that's one key point in terms of the beginning here.
So, remember thinking, how do you protect yourself if you're letting down all the walls? And I was really having trouble with that concept.
Ah, yeah.
Well, that's
a good question. Yeah.
You're not protecting yourself. You're giving that up because you realize it's a project that consumes so much of your life. And
yes,
as you protect yourself, you're cutting your own heart energy off from actually being connected to the world and to yourself, because you're also denying your own truth when you hold yourself back like that.
How do you keep people from doing bad things to you? I mean, you can't always keep it from happening, but...
I think this is could be a complicated question.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, but it's actually a very good question, and I think, first of all, you start making friends with your experience. And so, you know, as you develop, first of all, friends with yourself and acceptance of yourself, and you begin to realize that these other people's opinions, which are constantly in the process of shaping your mind and the way you feel about yourself, need to be examined very closely. This is one of the things that begins to happen as we settle in a meditation practice, because our first requirement, or as it were, the first priority in meditation is to settle our minds, is to actually bring us to some sense of inner tranquility, simplicity, and peace and presence. But that's not an end in itself, because actually once we do that, or once we establish ourselves in that, we can actually begin to examine what's going on. And, you know, when you really look at that, you can begin to realize that it's these are all connected with these kind of things, with this chimerical issue that happens when our minds are constantly being shaped by other people's perceptions and expectations and bouncing off of us, and they, in turn, shape our own mind and perception. So making friends with yourself and your perceptions is the first step, and this was part of what's going to be discussed in this book,
mm-hmm.
is we're learning how to do that. And then we're learning how to open up and face the fear of, obviously, anything, attack or, you know, who knows what. But the fearlessness is a quality that starts to pull off the kind of energies that attract negative situations to yourself. Being fearful actually magnetizes fearful situations. We're creating the world we live in. I mean, that sounds like a nice abstraction, but it actually happens when we do that. So we actually invite what we're trying to hide from.
So it's worthwhile noting that even though you may be inviting people in and opening up the space for them, you're not necessarily letting them do whatever they want, or taking what they say as gospel truth.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. No. You're not
I mean,
a doormat.
In the book, but it's
yeah.
worthwhile explicitly said.
Well, we'll be going into that more in terms of the practice of Maitri, and that's actually next week. So we'll be working with that more. But no. But there's still, you don't ever drop your critical mind,
mm-hmm.
and you know you have a clear. You start to have clarity about how you're going to work with situations. It's not that you're a doormat or you let things happen to you all the time that are harmful. No.
Part of what this comes from is something called discrimination. In Sanskrit, it's called prajna, and it just basically means we're capable of discerning what's good for us and what's not. If you invite somebody in their house and they start trashing it, you can tell them to leave. You're not under any obligation to invite harm to yourself or to anyone around you. And you don't have to accept perceptions that are improper or are engineered to make you feel bad.
Great.
Good.
This is Jeff. So maybe a silly question. You often refer to your teacher, and I sort of don't know. I'm wondering. I see names here. And I wonder where it would be located and how you say it. Is it
okay.
Just like Rinpoche or something?
Okay, it's right here in the very beginning. She says to the 16th Karmapa, and then she mentions
okay.
teachers. The third one down
uh-huh.
is Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche.
Okay.
So that's her main teacher. Chogyam.
That's your
Trungpa.
Teacher.
Yes.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Who taught me what it means to be fearless. Ah.
Thank
yeah.
You.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Right. So we'll be putting more things on the website. We're slowly working that in. One thing that we'll be putting up are like meditation, guide to meditation. I realized I rediscovered some material from a couple years ago from meditation practices that I gave. So they were recorded and they would be actually pretty useful because I listened to them today. I thought, oh, that sounds pretty good. Because sometimes you hear the meditation here, and it's good that you hear all of us because I think it's different. We each do it a little differently, which is, I think, really helpful. But there'll be some that will be online. So you if you want a different, you know, just listen to a guided meditation, you'll be able to listen to some online. And we'll be putting up more information about different recordings or things you can listen to. And there is definitely a wealth of material online, for sure. So we'll be scoping some things out. Did you want to say something about any of that, Michael?
Well, I think you just said that your meditation instruction online is very good. And by tomorrow, I expect I'm going to be working on it.
Good.
This afternoon we reviewed it, or you did.
Yeah, I got through three of the things. One is on Tonglen, so mm-hmm. you'll be presenting that the week after next.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on there. But, yeah.
So at least three, I don't know if you're going further than that, but
right, I haven't listened
basic
to
basic shamatha instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have one which is
Right. I haven't listened to the fourth one yet.
And you don't know what the other two are yet.
So we'll see.
But those three are quite good.
Yeah.
So if anyone doesn't have our web address, it's on that card, but I think everyone here has it right now.
And the book, information on how to get the book, it's online too. So, good. Does anyone have anything else? Questions or anything?
Oh, I'll ask another silly one.
No, that's okay.
I find it very difficult to try to sit up straight.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that, really? Because it just seems like if I sit like this, I'm just constantly aware of my back.
Right. Well, it is important to sit up straight. I don't know, are you flexible enough to sit on a cushion on the floor? Because sometimes sitting on a cushion can be actually a lot more comfortable than a chair, depending on your body. So we would like people to have a chance to try that. And, I'm happy to work with you afterwards for a minute, and you can see if a cushion might be better. For people that have at least some flexibility, in being able to sit cross-legged, sometimes the cushion is better because they feel more grounded on the floor. For me, my legs are really short, so chairs are really uncomfortable for me. I'm always dangling. So actually, to answer your question, having a straight back is important if you can do it. You know, it depends on your body too. But it has to do with actually the flow of energy in your body. And we're working with gravity and not against gravity. So sometimes I like to do exercises with people where they feel like you're almost leaning forward and you can feel how you're being pulled down.
Mm-hmm.
So it works the same when you're sitting. If you're actually in alignment with gravity and the earth, there's a sense of just relaxing on your spot, that you're actually supported by the earth, and there's not such a battle going on. And you find over time, you know, you start to be more familiar with different muscles in your body, and you're able to be more comfortable. So it's a process. But I would encourage you, we can try it afterwards for a minute if you want.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, those cushions are available for people to try, and we'll hopefully be getting more. So you can come early and try out a cushion, and we can help you with your posture if you'd like to do that. Or stay a little bit later and we can work with you.
I also have a meditation bench, which is another way. I remember I had a very difficult time when I started meditating. Really, I slouched and I had bad posture, and I remember just feeling my lower back muscles being pulled. And, you know, over time this can change, but meditation bench will take that off, because you're simply resting on a wooden bench with your knees down below and your legs tucked underneath. And you can also take a pillow and put it between your knees and sit like this, you know, so you're raised, so you're not really squishing your feet, and that's also a way. A lot of people in the Zen tradition did that, because they were sitting on the zafus, you know, so they could turn the zafu in between their legs, and they would be kind of it would be easy to sit up higher and keep your back without putting a strain on.
So obviously this is not a unique problem.
Not a unique problem. So that's why it's good to work with someone, you know, who can help find the right height for you, the right, you know, the right cushion. And we have two different styles. The round one is Japanese zafu, and the rectangular one is called a gomden, and it's higher. So sometimes that works better for some people that are taller too. So the main thing when you're sitting on the floor is that your knees are lower than your hips. Otherwise, you have a lot of strain in your back. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, you know, hints and clues, but it's really good to ask one of us to help you. And so you can try a cushion, and the chairs just may be difficult for you. Or if you end up in a chair, like you could have something under your feet. So you're, you know, that... Well, how tall are you?
About
5'4" or 5'5". Well, you're taller than me, so maybe you're okay with that. But leaning back, I think you do miss, if you're able to sit up away from the back of the chair, and sometimes just coming to the front can work even better, like if you use it as a bench. Like for me, this is much more comfortable than trying to sit into the back of the chair.
Okay,
it hurts your back.
Well, that's for one person can be torture for another person, so
right.
It's quite individual.
Yeah.
I can tell you I hate to sit in a chair and meditate.
I was wondering if walking at home is as good as sitting still.
Walking?
Or walking meditation.
Oh.
It's not the same.
No, it's not the same at all.
No, it's good to do. As a means to contrast the complete stillness and learning how to actually let yourself entirely settle.
Okay.
Because you're actually engaging in movement. And when you engage in movement, your mind starts processing things differently than when you're sitting still. You'll notice when you're even driving, and you're not necessarily moving, you're stationary in a car, but you're driving, and you'll notice the input of the visual stimulation will cause you mind to start processing a lot of things that wouldn't be happening if you were sort of staring into space. All of us could have some kind of ways of finding hitting the wall where it comes to points of where we just find it really uncomfortable. And unless we're willing to actually accept that and we can work with it, then we could just be driven away. We said, I can't deal with it. You know? I remember Jack Kerouac said, you know, he was famous for giving up meditation because he had a knee injury and he thought he had to be able to sit in the lotus position in order to meditate. And, you know, all he had to do was sit in a chair. You can also put pillows in the back of your lower back, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, you know, let's say you're sitting like this and your back, and you've got a big pillow here between you and the back, so you've got some support in your lumbar region. And still allows you to sit up without having to put a lot of strain on those those muscles.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the chair is really important, you know, a firm chair. And so, anyway, we can help you with that. That's okay. Well, everybody has those kind of questions, you know.
These are all important issues.
They are.
Yeah, I mean, finding the right balance. And you'll find it'll change over time, of course, you know, because your body will change and you get used to something, and what worked at one point might not work. So you just keep adjusting.
It also occurs to me that if we don't talk about these things and raise these questions, some of us can walk away thinking, I'll never get it.
Right.
Yeah. Knows what they're
right.
Doing.
Yeah. Well, that's so good. Well, that's why having the discussion is really good. I mean, we need to talk about what's mm-hmm. important to you. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to get help right at the get-go in terms of your meditation practice, so you don't feel you're doing it wrong or get discouraged. Or Mary, did you have a question?
I was just going to make a statement that sometimes even for me, part of my, if I'm fidgety inside myself, then I can sometimes have physical symptoms as well. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the quieter I get, the more centered, the more you do it, then your body starts to settle into a nice sort of balance. Mm-hmm. And then some of the physics, so not all of them, some of the physical stuff can kind of neutralize.
I can believe, because I just have the feeling it's like if I stop trying to sit up straight, I might be able to do it.
But there are times when we don't have that kind of stuff.
And I think in our life, sometimes we get used to hunching over a computer, and you start developing these other patterns, so you're counteracting that by actually using your muscles in a different way. So let's do our dedication of merit. So we just chant this at the end. By this merit, may all attain perfect awakening, rising above all forces of negativity, going beyond the turbulence of birth, old age, sickness, and death. May all beings be free from the ocean of samsara. To say also the reading for next week is up through chapter 7, so that will also be online if you forget. Thank you very much. See you next week. Okay, very good.
I'm loving all these socks. I should concentrate on the socks, particularly Deirdre's slippers are wonderful.